Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, April the 11th. And we will talk this hour about how doctors think with our guest, who is a doctor, who says that the way doctors think can lead to errors resulting in more injury or even death. Have you ever been to your doctor's office explaining your symptoms only to have the doctor jump in right away with a diagnosis and treatment? Our guest says, on average, this interruption will happen within the first 18 seconds of the doctor's visit. And while the doctor is usually correct in up to 25% of the cases, the doctor is wrong. In his book, How Doctors Think, Dr. Jerome Groopman tells us how we might help our doctors think better and get the best medical treatment we can. 1-800-642-1234 is our toll-free number to join in the discussion. Your questions are welcome, and maybe even your experiences in the doctor's office that illustrate his point. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Let me welcome our guest. Dr. Jerome Groopman holds the Dina and Raphael Recanati Chair of Medicine at the Harvard Medical School. He is Chief of Experimental Medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He is a staff writer at The New Yorker, has authored several editorials on policy issues in The New Republic, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. He is the author of many books. His most recent is How Doctors Think. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us about your own experience when you needed a doctor for your hand.
Well, I'm sort of an aging middle-aged athlete and had a series of traumas to my right hand, and I'm right-handed. The wrist became very painful, swollen, and red. I saw a hand surgeon who did x-rays and then an MRI and said, you know, I don't know what's wrong. Which was reassuring because he was honest. But over the series of months, the symptoms did not improve. And finally he said to me, well, I think you have a hyperreactive synovium and I need to strip the lining of your wrist. Now, it turns out that there is no such thing as a hyperreactive synovium.
Wow.
And you don't need to be a doctor to know that. You could Google search it or just check in a textbook or ask another opinion. So that was disturbing. I then went to a second physician, a hand surgeon, who looked at the MRI. And, you know, when you're 55 years old and you've been playing sports and so on, you have all sorts of changes on the scan. He wanted to do three sequential surgeries, trying to fix every little abnormality without really knowing what the primary problem was. The third hand surgeon was, as I describe, almost on roller skates. He zipped into the room, hardly examined me, didn't take a history really, and said, I think you have a form of gout in your wrist, which is very unusual. My wife was with me. I was in a lot of pain, like a lot of patients, and I said, well, you know, you don't see that on the x-rays. He said, oh, I'll figure it out when I open you up.
Goodness.
So finally, I went to a fourth hand surgeon, and I have a managed care plan, by the way, so it's not, you know, this required many years of searching. A young hand surgeon who did something different. He just didn't make a snap judgment or immediately looks at the x-rays. He listened carefully, took the history, and then said, you know, based on what you're telling me, I think the ligament is torn. I said, but it's not on the MRI. He said, well, maybe the MRI is not showing it. He did a series of very simple exams and tests, which indeed showed that that was the problem. And then he was very honest with me. He said, you know, I've never done this repair. I'm just starting my career. So I went to yet another hand surgeon who did a successful repair, but it was about 80% improvement after the surgery.
So all these different doctors were thinking different things. So what was going on here?
Well, I think, as you said in the introduction, you know, we're often right, and we use these shortcuts in thinking. And particularly in today's medical system where there's so much time pressure, doctors tend to jump and anchor onto the first idea that they have about the diagnosis. But a really good doctor, particularly when a symptom is not getting better or the cause is not obvious and clear, takes the time to listen carefully to the patient's story and also to try to integrate all the information and see what doesn't fit.
Yeah. We're going to check our weather forecast and a very wintry April weather forecast, and then we'll continue talking with Dr. Jerome Groopman. He is the author of the new book, How Doctors Think. And we will welcome your questions for him, your stories for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 17 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, April the 11th. I hope you stay tuned. Coming up, it's Jean Purcell in for Ben Marins this afternoon during At Issue between 4 and 6. After 5, it's the Supremes' Greatest Hits. Not music, but the 34 Supreme Court cases that most directly affect your life. That's coming up after 5. We're talking this hour with Dr. Jerome Groopman. He is the author of How Doctors Think. Our number to join in is 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. The book talks about how doctors can make errors in thinking, in judgment, make snap judgments, and maybe even misdiagnoses. The book talks about what we might do to help physicians think better so that we can receive the best medical treatment possible. And I'm wondering, Dr. Groopman, you also, as a doctor, are guilty of making these snap judgments?
Yes, the most egregious, the worst mistakes that I report in the book are my own. All of us as physicians are terrified of making mistakes, and we're all fallible. We're human. And we use these shortcuts in thinking when we deal with uncertainty. So one of the most important kinds of errors we make are called attribution errors, where we stereotype someone in our mind, and then we attribute their symptoms to the stereotype that we've arrived at pretty quickly. When I was a resident many years ago, an older woman was complaining of discomfort under her breastbone. And I felt she was a complainer and a whiner, and I thought she had indigestion and gave her antacids. But I failed to open my mind up when her complaints persisted. And several weeks later, she was rushed to the emergency room, and she had a tear in the aorta, the large vessel that takes blood from the heart. And that accounted for her discomfort under her breastbone, and she died. And even though my colleague said, oh, well, you know, she was older, and this is often fatal, and so on, I've never forgotten that, and I've never forgiven myself fully for that.
Yeah. Is this the shortcuts in thinking something that, I don't know, is taught in medical school?
Unfortunately not, and that's part of my reason for writing the book. What's taught in medical school are these algorithms or guidelines, and they're useful to consult, but they deal with standard patients as though all of us were generic, you know, one size fits all. The kinds of thinking that we do in our office, the real thinking that occurs in the emergency room, involves these shortcuts. And as you said earlier, they often succeed, but often they don't. And so I believe it's imperative that medical students are taught, as well as residents and senior doctors, how we think and how we can think better.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers who do want to talk with you, so let me bring on Jane in Madison. Hi, Jane, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I want to talk to you about a misdiagnosis of colon cancer. I went to a local Madison doctor with rectal bleeding, and he said I had hemorrhoids, and gave me some medicine and told me to come back in 6 weeks. And I called my doctor at Mayo Clinic, and his nurse said, can you come in today? And I said, no, but tomorrow. So So I went in the next day. I had a CAT scan in the afternoon. I had a colonoscopy the following day. The fourth day after I called her, I knew I had colon cancer. And the fifth day, we called in my kids to make plans if I was going to have radiation chemo or if I was going to have surgery.
Yeah, and Dr. Grubman, you want to react to that?
Yeah, well, first, I think you're fortunate and you were wise to seek a second opinion. You know, this is an example where the first impression, which is hemorrhoids, which often can cause rectal bleeding, but you have to question yourself. You always, as a physician, have to say to yourself, what else could it be? And when you, as a patient, are given a diagnosis, particularly if it could be a serious diagnosis like cancer as opposed to hemorrhoids, it's perfectly appropriate to say to the physician, what else could it be? And that causes him or her to open his mind and not anchor, make one of these anchoring errors where you become fixed on your initial impression.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jane, for the story. You also tell the story of the story of Ann Dodge. It was startling, actually. Tell us about Ann Dodge and what she had to go through for like 15 years.
Yeah, Ann Dodge is 35 years old, comes from a town south of Massachusetts, and when she was about 20, she found that food didn't agree with her. She developed discomfort in her upper belly, and it was so bad, and she got so queasy that she would go to the bathroom and vomit. And pretty quickly, she was diagnosed as having an eating disorder, bulimia, vomiting, and anorexia, you know, sort of dislike of food. And for 15 years, she deteriorated. She was down to 82 pounds when I heard about her case. She had seen over 30 doctors, and each one accepted this initial diagnosis until she met a doctor named Dr. Myron Falchuk, and he did something quite remarkable. Instead of just accepting the diagnosis, he put her medical records to the side and said, tell me your story again from the beginning. And she said, I'm trying desperately to eat 3,000 calories a day. No one believed her. They had hospitalized her in a psychiatric facility. And it turned out she did have psychological problems, but importantly, she had celiac disease. She's allergic to the gluten, which is a major component of the cereal and the pasta and the bread that everyone was forcing down her.
So she's making herself sicker by eating the 3,000 calories a day.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, here's an example where a doctor can say to himself, you know, what else could it be, and could two things be going on simultaneously? And Dr. Falchuk saved her life after 30 doctors had really missed and not thought because they just, you know, closed their minds.
Yeah. Did Dr. Falchuk, that's what he asked himself, what else could be going on, or did he just recognize this particular, that was his diagnosis?
No, he worked systematically. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. The way he describes it is he says, you know, it's like DNA evidence at the scene of a crime. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone says, I'm innocent, well, then what more do you have to look for to prove or disprove? This young woman was saying, you know, I'm trying. I'm eating all of this. I am taking 3,000 calories a day. In a way, she's like someone in prison who says, I'm innocent. So he said, okay, let me consider what else could it be and what test do I need to do to prove or disprove her contention.
Yeah. Let's go now to Michael in Appleton. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Good morning, everybody. How are you?
Good.
I'm an East Coasterist transplanted here, so I just want to comment on a couple things. I think that one of the major mistakes the consumer has that they commit is they do not look at the medical industry as a business, and that they have a right as a consumer of services to ensure that doctors or anyone in a practicing fashion is providing a service that's not only safe and adequate, that it meets their needs. And we put faith in doctors at times like they're deities, That is an absolute failure. Measuring doctors is also a problem, because if you buy an automobile that doesn't work right, you can go and complain to the manufacturer, but if you try to complain about a doctor, it falls sometimes on deaf ears. Determining the doctor's competency is a problem because of the potential for their malpractice. So with that springboard, one of the things I find fascinating is that, yes, doctors are going to make mistakes. People, human beings make mistakes. Failures teach you. But the challenge is the human being is the petri dish of that failure. And, I personally have sleep apnea. I didn't know I had it. I probably had it my whole life. And I developed erectile dysfunction, and I didn't know it was as a result of a sleep apnea because it wasn't diagnosed. So they're giving me Viagra and Cialis and making my heart go crazy. And then finally, another doctor said, gee, you might have sleep apnea. You should go to a pulmonary specialist. Well, once we treated it, everything subsequently to that was corrected. Is it fair to say that doctors are not going to make mistakes? Of course they are, but there must be a way to measure the doctor, just like a performance criteria at a conventional company, that lets the doctor learn from the mistakes without a lawsuit. I think that would be a great thing to see.
Dr. Groopman?
Well, I think a few of the points you make, first of all, we're not gods. It's very, very hard for us. We want to be right all the time, but we can't be right all the time. Now, in terms of how to evaluate who is a good doctor, that's a really complicated issue. The kind of performance report cards that are being suggested, unfortunately, are sort of the lowest common denominator. It's like, do you give people a flu shot? Do you check their blood sugar? Which everyone should do. And it's you don't need to be a doctor to do that. The kind of story that you report about yourself requires a really thinking doctor, someone who doesn't accept the momentum of the diagnosis and considers another possibility, in your case, sleep apnea. And how to find those kinds of doctors? Often, interestingly, it's the nurses who know a lot about who's really thinking and who isn't, as well as other physician colleagues. There is no easy answer, but it's a very, very important point that you bring up.
Yeah. And you also suggest that if you just don't feel that you get along well with your doctor, that maybe you don't like your doctor or you think your doctor doesn't like you, to find another doctor.
Well, there's a very interesting team, two women, Deborah Roeder at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore and Judy Hall in Northeastern in Boston. They've studied emotion and relationships between physicians and patients. And when your doctor doesn't like you, most patients feel that, but they blame themselves. When I asked other physicians if they felt their doctor didn't like them, if they were a patient, every doctor I spoke to said he would find another doctor. Mm-hmm. But the flip side, which I write about, is that sometimes a physician can like a patient too much. I made a mistake because I really, became sort of too caring in a way of a young man who was a big book reader and had a serious cancer. And I didn't want to add to his discomfort one day, so I didn't take the bed sheets off and roll him around and so on because he looked so miserable. And I missed an important infection on his back, which luckily did not kill him. But it was my own liking too much.
Right. We'll talk more with Dr. Jerome Groopman, author of How Doctors Think, about how doctors think, after we check the latest news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 7:36 on this Wednesday, April the 11th. We are talking about how doctors think. That's the name of the book by our guest, a physician, who says that too often physicians will take shortcuts in thinking, and this could lead to a misdiagnosis, and that could have dire consequences. Talking about how you as a patient might help your doctor think better and get the best medical treatment you can, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your questions. We welcome your experiences. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. You can also send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Talking about how doctors figure out the best treatments or how they fail to do so. Our guest is Jerome Groopman, MD. He holds the chair of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. He is chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, staff writer at The New Yorker, has authored many books. His most recent is How Doctors Think. And back to the phones we go. Connie in Arcadia is next. Hi, Connie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. I'm thinking of I live in a small town that when in the past a doctor in a small town would know who you were, know you, your family, your upbringing, and so forth, and that kind of leads into the whole system these days seems to dehumanize us. You know, the doctor sees me for 5 minutes and sees me as a bunch of symptoms rather than knowing me as who I am. And that seems to me to probably lead into the system is much as much at fault as individual physicians.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Groopman?
That is a very important point. The system is preventing us as physicians from thinking well, from communicating effectively with patients, from really drawing out the symptoms, how they occurred, and also placing it, as you say, within the context of your life. Unfortunately, a lot of the people who run the medical care now see it as a factory. And, you know, physicians are being told you can see people in 12 minutes, 14 minutes, you know, in and out they go. They also have to fill out all these checklists, you know, to document everything so that bills are coded in a certain way. All of this can inhibit the kind of communication which is so essential to get to the root cause of what's wrong.
Yeah, Connie, thank you very much for the call. I don't know if it was the system or the physician in the case of my sister. My sister recently changed doctors, in fact, because she was having constant battles with her physician over the care that she thought she needed or that her children needed. One example was she wanted a thyroid test for her daughter, who was exhibiting symptoms of a deficient thyroid, and my sister knows about this because she has a deficient thyroid. And the doctor said, no, she doesn't need the test. She's too young to be worrying about that. Then after that battle, she got the test. It did show that she did have a thyroid problem. No, she doesn't need treatment because she's too young, and let's just wait on this. My sister insisted that she wanted to see a specialist, and no, she doesn't need a specialist. There had to be a referral, and battle. It turned out that she did need Synthroid, and now all of those symptoms are gone, and she's doing much, much better. But that's just one example of many of battling. When a patient tries to influence the care that she's getting, that still didn't work. What do you have to say about that, Dr. Groopman?
Well, you know, a good physician sees a patient and a family as a partner. We can't think well unless we really partner with you, get the information, think with you. If someone closes his or her mind and dismisses your concerns, that is not the kind of doctor, certainly, that I would want. And, you know, as the caller said before, and I say, none of us is perfect. We can make mistakes. When someone, particularly thyroid disease, which runs strongly in families, my wife's family has a big history of thyroid disease, you know, you have to open your mind up again and say, well, maybe this child doesn't fit the typical picture. Mm-hmm. And that shows a really good doctor who can think outside the box.
Yeah, and the remedy that my sister eventually did is that she did indeed change doctors. Sometimes you have to do that.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. And as I said before, mm-hmm. when I speak to other physicians about relationship, if they were a patient on the other side of the table, they would not stay with a doctor who they felt dismissed them or was irritated with them.
Yeah. Next we go to Ron in West Bend. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. My experience recently was with my mom at age 90, where a person becomes far more fragile, no question about it. And back in January, She had some change around the heart. We still haven't figured out just what. And so the obvious treatment was to put her on a diuretic to get rid of the water and a nitro patch. Okay. But long range, it would also be nice to probably bring down her cholesterol level, which they really didn't know what it was, and put her on a statin. So they put her on all three right away. And she started to have more and more cognitive problems. And we thought, well, lack of circulation, that's affecting the brain. And her family doctor knows her very well, and he saw the problem. But it wasn't until I talked to a friend out in Spring Green that mentioned that statins in some people can cause all kinds of cognitive problems. And finally, I says, this is changing day by day. It can't be Alzheimer's. There was no evidence of a stroke. They did an MRI. And so it has to be the drug. And finally, they said, well, I guess maybe we could try that. We took her off the statin. She was better in 24 hours. So what I've seen there is, one, they changed three drugs at once. The statin was not essential to do. The other thing, and I've seen it in the hospital in St. Luke's in Milwaukee, the same thing, how does a doctor track from, and not just the doctors, the nurse, from one nurse to the next, of what the changes in a person's mental condition is?
A lot there, Dr. Grootman.
Well, you bring up several important points. First is that with elderly people, often they're stereotyped so that, you know, they're said, well, it's just circulation because they're in their 80s or 90, or, you know, they're weak because it's old age. And that's not really a diagnosis. You have to think openly. The second, though, if I can extract from your story, is that there's this imperative now for a lot of physicians that you have to follow these cookbook recipes, as opposed to individualizing or customizing treatment. So if someone's cholesterol is high and she's 90 years old, which means she's probably had this high cholesterol for decades and decades and decades, from common sense, it means that for her body, it's okay. But, you know, if you don't get that cholesterol down, when we were talking before about report cards and performance, you know, you could be penalized. So the knee-jerk response on a lot of physicians, they're being forced to say, okay, I have to prescribe a statin so it looks good on paper. But that, as you point out, can have deleterious effects in some people. So you really have to look at each person as an individual.
Our guest is Jerome Grootman, MD, author of How Doctors Think. We're talking about how we might help physicians think better so we can receive the best medical treatment possible. His book talks about how doctors often decide within the first 18 seconds of talking to a patient about his or her symptoms, the likely diagnosis and treatment, and how that while this is often correct, the doctor is often correct, sometimes the doctor is wrong, and trying to figure out how we can avoid that. And avoid these shortcuts in thinking that doctors often take. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 13 minutes before 8 o'clock, coming up after 8. We'll talk with Eugene Kane, a columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about the mess that Don Imus is in. That's coming up after 8. We're talking with Dr. Jerome Grootman during this hour. He is, among other things, the chair of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and he is the author of many books. His most recent is How Doctors Think, which illustrates how doctors think and how this sometimes can lead to a misdiagnosis. And our next caller is Tom in Sobieski. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi,
Sobieski, I'm sorry, that's right. I swear that I want to say Sobieski, though, Tom.
That's okay. That sounds good anyway. My comment and question kind of is, don't you feel that the insurance companies are kind of driving how doctors are practicing, what they're ordering, how much they're ordering, because of the reimbursement issues, and they're even talking about cutting reimbursement more to physicians and healthcare organizations. I was just wondering what your comment is regarding that.
Absolutely. There are two things the insurance companies are doing. One is that they make it very, very difficult if a doctor wants to deviate from one of these cookbook recipes and order a test because he or she thinks that there may be something else going on. The other is that thinking medicine, primary care doctors, pediatricians, internists, who don't do procedures but sit with you and try to figure out what's wrong, they're paid very, very poorly. While if you do procedures, surgery or put a needle in something, biopsy, you're much more richly reimbursed. So it's very lopsided. And basically, the insurance industry is driving, to my mind, doctors away from thinking and more to just doing. And sometimes that's not the best thing for the patient.
Tom, thanks for the call. Tara in De Pere is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I have been having issues, stomach issues, I guess, for the past year or so. I've had colonoscopies, endoscopies, and other tests. Nothing has been found in those regards. And what the thinking is now is that perhaps I have endometriosis. I wondered if the doctor could comment on not only doctors who aren't really getting it in general, but how, when it comes to perhaps something that's special to a woman, how that might block a diagnosis even more.
So if I understand your question, because there was a little gap on my end here, specifically for a woman, often women, unfortunately, are stereotyped, particularly women who are having hormonal problems, entering menopause, that sometimes their symptoms are attributed to stress and anxiety. Sometimes it can be stress and anxiety, but it could also very well be a physical cause. I think it's helpful to see specialists who are attentive to women's health and are expert in that, so that they can really look at all of the possibilities with you and systematically see what tests have been done, what fits with your history and symptoms, what more might need to be done to get to the bottom of what's wrong.
Is there, in general, in the from doctors in the medical community, kind of a lack of understanding about particular conditions to women?
I think this was true in the past more than it is now, but it depends, of course, whom you're seeing and so on. But many of the larger medical centers now have programs which are specifically focused and devoted to women's health issues, and I think getting a second opinion at a place like that is certainly very valuable if you feel that your problem is not really being explained.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tara. Yeah, I think I heard you on in a national public radio interview talking about how maybe women going through menopause or perimenopause. You told the story about one particular woman who saw her doctor and it was just kind of attributed to, you know, menopause, but she really did have a very serious issue. What was her story?
This is a woman I call Ellen Barnett. I changed the names for confidentiality of all the patients. But basically, she was, as you say, an anxious person who was going through menopause, and she felt there were these explosions, as she put it, in her body. And she saw four doctors with this persistent complaint, and they all just dismissed her. They made this attribution error, stereotyped her. You know, you're a nervous, high-strung woman in menopause. Till she finally found a doctor who listened to her. And the patient said, you know, maybe I am high-strung. Maybe I am looking kooky to you. So that breaks the stereotype. But something's really different. I feel these explosions in my body. And that physician listened carefully and thought about it. And it turned out that the patient had a tumor producing adrenaline. So every once in a while, there would be this explosion. because there would be a burst of adrenaline that was released into her bloodstream. And luckily, the tumor was found early enough, taken out, and she did well afterwards.
Now, was the difference that she said to this doctor, I know that I'm, you know, nervous and tense usually, but something's different now. Something has changed. Was that the difference in this visit with this doctor, or was there something different about the doctor?
I think it was both. Mm-hmm. Again, this boils down to the partnership, that you have a patient who knows how doctors can stereotype, who knows how doctors think well and mm-hmm. also make mistakes. So she's opening up the conversation in a very candid way, saying implicitly, don't stereotype me. And then you have a physician whose mind is open and realizes that it's too easy to stereotype and doesn't want to.
Tanya in Holman is with us now. Hi, Tanya. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to comment on your point earlier of seeing a second physician and a third and a fourth if necessary, because I went through a situation where I was misdiagnosed for 3 years, and they repeatedly told me I had a pulled muscle, and it turned out to be much, much more severe. And I insisted on seeing a specialist, but they handed me to a specialist within the same clinic who opened my file and basically had his opinion made up before he even looked at me. He did not ever touch me, in meaning he never went through an analysis of anything on me. He just looked at me, asked me a couple questions, and said, oh, yeah, you have a pulled muscle. And so I just really felt like, because I was within the same clinic, the doctor who had seen me before had more clout than I did as a patient, and had I known what I know now, I would have definitely gone and left that institution altogether and gone somewhere else, because I ended up having something much, much more serious.
Well, Tanya, that is a very important point, and basically what you want when you want a second opinion is to go outside of that single practice, because there's a tendency, first of all, for groupthink, for herd instinct, and also what you're describing, I describe in the book called diagnosis momentum. Once one doctor sort of puts into play a diagnosis, it's kind of like a boulder rolling down a hill, and so it just keeps going. And what you want to do is to go to a different clinic or a different hospital, to a doctor who is going to not just accept at face value what the first one thought.
Yeah. Got an email from Dave in Madison, and he wonders if you have ever seen the TV show House, which he says specializes in dramatic rapid-fire diagnoses. And actually, I think the doctor on House is kind of a curmudgeon, too. But have you ever seen that show? I have any comment on how the medical profession is portrayed in House?
Yeah, well, House, it's interesting. A colleague of mine writes a column for the L.A. Times about TV medicine and all of the inaccuracies. House is basically Sherlock Holmes, down to having a drug addiction with the doctor. There's a lot of snap judgments, and unfortunately, in real medicine, in the real world, what you need to do is to not have that first impression guide you, but you have to question yourself, you have to dig deeply. Sometimes it takes a while, like with my wrist, to get to the bottom of what's really wrong.
Yeah. Another email from Merle in Appleton, who says she is in a grief support group, and many of the members of this group have lost their husbands due to cancer. And the theme, a main theme that comes through time and again, is how indifferent and or erroneous the care was that they received from their doctors. Everybody there thinks that care could be improved if MDs had to attend these listening sessions or these support groups so they hear the concerns of patients and their families. What do you think?
Well, I think that I'm a cancer specialist, mm-hmm. as you may know, and I think we can do a much better job in terms of being sensitive. I portray two other oncologists in the book, both of whom I think are the kinds of doctors you would want if you had serious cancer, because they think not only about the person's body, but also about his spirit or soul, if we can use that word, about his needs and his beliefs and his, the way he wants to live his life and the time that remains. And I think these kinds of issues are really important.
And we'll leave it there. It was a fascinating book. Dr. Groopman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jerome Groopman, author of How Doctors Think. He is also the chair of the Harvard Medical School, chief of experimental medicine at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, staff writer for The New Yorker and many other publications. His most recent book is How Doctors Think, published by Houghton Mifflin. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour and to Karen Prager for on-air production. Thank you, as always, for listening and for calling in. If you would like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, call the radio store 1-800-747-7444, 1-800-747-7444, or you can also listen to our talk shows that are archived on our website through your computer, wpr.org, wpr.org. Thanks again for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.